Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Herpes Zoster, Strategies for Prevention, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Gregory A. Poland, M.D., Michael N. Oxman, M.D., and Kenneth Schmader, M.D. Dr. Poland is a Mary Lowell Levy Professor of Medicine, Department of Infectious Diseases, Mayo Clinic School of Medicine. Director, Mayo Vaccine Research Group, Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Poland has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Novavax, Merck & Company, Avianax, Emergent Biosolutions, Theraclone Sciences, Liquidia Technologies, Dynavax, Paxvax, Novartis Vaccines and Diagnostics, and EMD Serono. He received grants for clinical research from Novavax and Merck & Company. Dr. Poland does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Poland does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Oxman is a professor of medicine and pathology, University of California, San Diego, staff physician for infectious diseases, VA San Diego Healthcare System, San Diego, California. Dr. Oxman has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He owns stock, stock options, or bonds from GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer. Dr. Oxman does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Oxman does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Schmader is a professor of medicine, chief, Division of Geriatrics, Duke University and Durham VA Medical Centers, Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Schmader has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Merck & Company. He received grants for clinical research from Merck & Company and Inhibitex. Dr. Schmader does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Schmader does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The goal of this activity is to provide clinicians with recent changes to the indications for the Zoster vaccine in adults and increase the rate of vaccination against Zoster, which will in turn decrease the associated burden of disease. This activity is supported by Merck & Company. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Greg Poland from the Mayo Clinic. I'd like to welcome you to the CME and CE certified program titled Herpes Zoster, Strategies for Prevention. I'd also like to welcome my two colleagues, Dr. Mike Oxman from the University of California, San Diego, and Dr. Ken Schmader from Duke University. As we begin here, let me just sort of get us started by making the comment that herpes zoster is a very common problem in adult practice. It has significant consequences worthy of prevention. We are fortunate in having a vaccine that's been licensed since 2006. And I hope what we'll get to through this program today is really the value of preventing zoster as opposed to trying to treat it alone. Let's start with a polling question for our audience. In which of the following do you routinely recommend the shingles vaccine? So let's start off with asking the question, why do we need a shingles vaccine?
Well, shingles is very common, as you mentioned, Craig. There are probably over 1 million cases each year in the United States. And not only is shingles occurring, but the bad pain that goes along with it, which is difficult to manage. So preventing it would be a huge impact on people's health.
I've heard estimates of the lifetime risk of shingles for any one of us being somewhere in the neighborhood of 20, maybe up to 30%. Is that an accurate estimate, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. Those are the figures I've seen.
And if so, Ken, what are the implications for us as a society? You're a geriatrician, and we've all become, I think, attuned to the fact that we are a rapidly aging society.
That's right. The incidence of herpes zoster goes up dramatically with aging, and with population aging, we're going to have many more cases in the future, and many more cases of not just zoster, but pain and post-traumatic
neuralgia. So that lifetime risk is going to increase as the lifetime gets longer.
Absolutely, yes. So absent a vaccine, so prior to 2006, really the only thing that we could do as practitioners would be to treat an episode of zoster once it's occurred. And there's still a role for treatment, but let's talk just very briefly about the problems with treatment.
Well, once shingles develops, treatment can shorten the episode and it can reduce the pain in the episode modestly, but it has very little effect on the most common debilitating complication, and that is the persistence of pain after the rash heals, post-herpetic neuralgia, which is really the nightmare for older people as far as I can see.
And how often does that occur?
Again, it depends on age and it depends on how you define it. The risk is, in the study that we did, Ken and his colleagues and I did, the risk of pain that persists beyond 90 days was 14% of cases of zoster in people 60 and over.
Although that was an idealized clinical trial setting, and it's probably higher in general practice.
It's probably higher in the general practice.
So I think the point that we've made is that while we certainly would utilize treatment once an episode of zoster has occurred, it's not an optimal way of dealing with this disorder. It has limitations in terms of what we can achieve with it. And I think, Ken, going again back to the idea that this is primarily an older, in many cases, geriatric population, there are side effects to those drugs that may not be tolerated well.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of the drugs we use for pain, although they can be effective for pain relief, have tremendous side effects. Opioids, anticonvulsants, corticosteroids, et cetera. So prevention is much better.
Okay. And let's talk a little bit about the incidence of zoster with age, because that really informs what the recommendations would be for prevention of that disease. So, Mike, can you say something about that?
Yes, I think we really owe a debt to a wonderful British physician who, in his general practice, studied patients for 16 years, drank in the local pub, didn't miss a single case of zoster, I'm sure, and published a landmark paper in 1965 in which he showed that the incidence and severity increased markedly with increasing age. And he made one other observation, and it may be related to the fact that the life expectancy was relatively short, but he observed that he didn't see very many second episodes of shingles. And he hypothesized that that was because the first episode boosted immunity, whatever that was at the time, and acted like a vaccine.
Right, right. Traditionally, it was thought that if you had an episode of zoster, you were pretty much protected, as Mike was mentioning in Dr. Hope Simpson's studies, from further episodes. We now know with increasing lifespan that may not be the case and that there is a considerable recurrence rate.
That's correct. There's a recent paper showing that the recurrence rate is higher than we had seen previously, about 6 to 8%.
Yeah, so another reason for us to really think about prevention, even if a prior episode of zoster has occurred. The reason that Dr. Simpson noticed an increase in zoster with age was somewhat unclear. He hypothesized that there was some diminution in immunity. But we now know exactly the basis for that. Mike, do you want to comment on that, since was a part of the study
you did? Hope Simpson hypothesized that when you developed chickenpox and established the latent infection with the virus in your sensory neurons, you also got immunized by that, as is true of any primary infection. But that immunity gradually declined over time. And when it reached some critical level, which we don't know, then the virus in the ganglion could not only reactivate, but multiply and do great damage to those nerve cells, and also then come down the nerve and produce the rash in the skin. And what we know now, after 40 years, is that the nature of that immunity that's important is cell-mediated immunity, as opposed to antibody.
Right.
And we see that fading out as we get older, the cell-mediated immunity to the varicella zoster virus. And we also see a tremendous increase in the age-specific incidence in people who have defects in cellular immunity, like people with HIV infection, where it's the sentinel opportunistic infection.
Right, yes, good point. Very good point. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the vaccine itself and how it was developed. Ken, you want to comment on that?
The vaccine was developed by Dr. Takahashi in Japan, and this was an extraordinarily tough thing to do, because when you're developing a live attenuated vaccine, you want to make sure that it is not too virulent and kills the host, but it also has to be immunogenic and also produce a good immune response, and he was able to do that in the 1970s. And we found out that it was effective against varicella, but later, it turned out that we needed a higher dose to be effective against zoster. Mike, did you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, well, the varicella vaccine was licensed in 1995, and it's basically almost eliminated chickenpox in the United States. And the difficulty is that in order to be effective, it's a live attenuated vaccine. It has to grow a little bit, at least. And we're immune to chickenpox. We generally do not get chickenpox again. So it takes, you know, 10 to 15 or 20 times as much virus to make a zoster vaccine to immunize people who already are resistant to chickenpox.
Good point. Let me take us back almost 10 years ago or so. An interesting confluence of events. Dr. Takahashi in Japan has isolated the virus, developed an attenuated version of it that could be used as a vaccine. We now had the theoretical basis for vaccination, knowing that with increasing age, cell-mediated immunity was waning, allowing for reactivation of the virus at the same time that society was rapidly aging because of the increased lifespan. That was the perfect setup for the landmark study that you all did. Mike, you were the PI of the shingles prevention study. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, this VA cooperative study, which involved 22 study sites, Ken's was one of the most important ones, looked at people who were immunocompetent and ambulatory and 60 years of age and older. And we picked that point because clearly at age 60, zoster is beginning to have a very significant impact, and there's a lot of post-herpetic neuralgia, which is the most common debilitating complication. And this was a very large VA cooperative study with 38,546 people.
You remember exactly.
Exactly, very painful. And half of them got vaccine and half got placebo. It was double blind, so neither they nor we knew which was which.
So just the right study design.
Just the right simple-minded study design, imitating Hope Simpson. And essentially we followed them for up to five, but an average of a bit over 3 years. And we set the mark very low for detecting a possible case of shingles, so that we wouldn't miss any mild or vaccine-modified cases. And so we could use the placebo group as a way of prospectively looking at the natural history of the disease. And we've finally finished that study, and remarkably, the vaccine was effective.
Now, one of the key things about the study that you did, which I thought was really helpful to us as practitioners, is you looked not only at efficacy in preventing zoster, but the complications that occur that are really what impact people's lives. So maybe talk about the other endpoints briefly that you studied in the trial.
Well, pain is the name of the game in shingles, so pain was actually the primary endpoint of the trial. And we measured it in two ways. One was to look at pain intensity over time, or pain severity over time, which we called the burden of illness, and also the incidence of postherpetic neuralgia.
Good, okay. And you actually had formal endpoints for that. I think you called it the severity of illness.
The burden, yeah. In an individual person, the severity of illness was the area under a curve where the top of the curve was the severity and the abscissa was the duration. Really, because if you had a very short period of severe pain, you could put up with it. And if you had a very long period of very, very mild pain, you could put up with it. But the combination of severe pain and long duration was devastating.
This issue of pain or postherpetic neuralgia, let's expand a little bit on that, because as Ken said, this was really the primary endpoint of the study. I worry sometimes that practitioners maybe have seen the study and they focus just on the efficacy of preventing zoster, which is important. But what's really important in terms of function and quality of life is this issue of pain. So what can we say about that in relation to age, for example?
Well, clearly postherpetic neuralgia goes up with age, and the trial showed that the vaccine did prevent postherpetic neuralgia. Some of that was because there was no herpes zoster. If you don't have zoster, you don't develop pain. But it also had a salutary effect on postherpetic neuralgia and pain independent of that.
Now, you had a placebo arm, and there were people, of course, because they were in the placebo arm and didn't get the vaccine, who developed zoster. What kind of pain burden did they have?
Well, they had very significant pain burden. It was about twice what was going on in the vaccine group, absolutely.
Good. So, Mike, you published this in the New England Journal. I've forgotten what year it was.
2005.
2005, so a relatively recent study. And let's get right into the details of the efficacy of the vaccine. So let's talk first about the efficacy of the vaccine for burden of illness.
The burden of illness, which is basically the product of if you prevent it, you don't have a burden of illness. Mm. If you don't prevent it, but you modify it and make it much less severe, you reduce the burden of illness. So overall, the burden of illness was reduced by 61%. And we had set in advance the requirement that for this to be called effective, we had to be better than 47%. Mm. So we exceeded that. And then we divided the population into two age groups, 60 to 69 and 70 and over, and randomized them in each site. And so we have data in these two age groups, and it's very impressive in the placebo group that the burden of illness in those people who got placebo was enormously higher in the 70 and over group than in the 60 to 69 group. And the vaccine efficacy for the burden of illness was a little bit less in that group, but it was still way over 47. It was 55.5%. But the gain, because there's so much more misery, if you will, in that older age group, the total gain, I think, was substantially greater in that group.
How about the change in the incidence of herpes zoster itself in vaccine recipients versus placebo recipients?
Well, in the younger age group, the major benefit was a reduction in the incidence. So,
of
zoster. And if you didn't get zoster, you didn't get postherpetic neuralgia. But in the older age group, and this is not well appreciated, the major gain was not in reducing the incidence, but in reducing the severity. And that impacted postherpetic neuralgia. And the result of that was that the vaccine reduced the incidence, that's the number of cases per 1,000 people per year who got vaccine versus placebo, reduced it by 2/3 in the younger age group, largely by preventing it, and in the older age group, largely by modifying it.
This, I think, is really a key point. So let's take a minute to sort of recapitulate that, rearticulate that. The real value of the vaccine in younger people is the ability to prevent zoster. But the real value, Ken, in our geriatric patients is a little bit different. Can you just comment on that?
And that's incredibly important because what older people want to do is maintain their independence. And when you get a bad case of post-traumatic neuralgia or herpes zoster, it's going to threaten your independence, reduce your ability to do activity of the daily living. And the fact that this vaccine can reduce the chance of that happening is really important.
So really a reduction in the burden of illness and in post-herpetic neuralgia. Yeah. Okay, very good. Let's talk about the efficacy of the vaccine then for that specific issue of post-herpetic neuralgia.
Well, the vaccine reduced the incidence of post-herpetic neuralgia by 2/3 in the younger, the 60 to 69-year-old age group, but also in the people who were 70 and over. It just did it in a subtly different way, and that is by the biggest effect in the older group was not to prevent zoster, but to markedly reduce its severity.
And I know I'm emphasizing this point, but it's because I think all of our clinical experience has been of colleagues coming up and saying, well, gee, you know, when you get to the older subjects, you're talking about an efficacy, a reduced efficacy in preventing zoster. You know, we're down in the 50% range or something. But that's not the point. The point is that in these older people, what we're really attempting to do with the vaccine is to attenuate the complications of zoster, primary among them being post-herpetic neuralgia. Would you say that's the right way to articulate it?
I think that's the right way to articulate it. I think what motivated all of us to get started with this was the frustration with the development of good antiviral drugs. We didn't prevent post-herpetic neuralgia. And so, you know, this is why I think we were driven to use, to try to develop a vaccine.
Treatment was suboptimal, and it really is about prevention.
And furthermore, our treatments of post-herpetic neuralgia fall short, too.
Good point. Let's now ask about one of the secondary endpoints, and that was the efficacy of the vaccine to prevent zoster.
Well, it prevented zoster with an efficacy of about almost 64% in the 60 to 69-year-old group.
And what about
but
the older
age? But in the older group, it dropped to 37.5%. Yeah. And you can expect that to be even more reduced in the older group. And so in some places, I have had patients in their 80s being told that they shouldn't get vaccinated because it won't work. And that clearly is not true because the important thing is that in that group, it almost certainly reduces post-herpetic neuralgia by 2/3.
Right.
Now, recently, the age at which the vaccine is approved has been reduced so that it's now approved for use in people not 60 and over, but 50 and over.
Right. Now, this is a brand new development. Let's maybe, Ken, talk a little bit about that trial.
Yes, it was called the ZEST trial, and it was done in individuals 50 to 59, an international trial with a similar design to the shingles prevention study. And it showed, like the shingles prevention study, that the vaccine did reduce the incidence of shingles quite significantly, similarly as the SBS.
So we now have a recommendation, or at least a license, for the vaccine to be used in people age 50 and older. And there's one other point that I think bears making here. When you guys did this study, you were really operating under very optimal conditions. You had a setup. Mike, I've heard you talk about a patient would call on a Thursday night. They'd be seen Friday morning according to a preset protocol. The implication of that, I think, is that your estimates of efficacy are actually lower than what they probably would be in real life.
I think that's true because we felt obliged to give patients the best treatment possible. So every patient was seen as early as possible, and they were offered the most effective antiviral therapy, and they were treated for pain. So since these were the endpoints, we kind of, in order to protect the patient or the subject, to some extent shot ourselves in the foot a little bit, not fatally, fortunately.
Yeah, furthermore, in the idealized clinical setting here, we were really going after efficacy, but the main question is it also effective in real-world practice? There's a recent publication in JAMA showing that it was in real-world practice that the vaccine reduced the incidence of herpes zoster as much as the shingles prevention study.
So I think we've really established through our discussions today that prevention is the key here, that we've got a safe and effective vaccine to do so. But let's just summarize by saying, Mike, I'll ask you about the indications for the vaccine, and Ken, a little bit about the contraindications for the vaccine. So who should be getting this vaccine?
I think that anyone 60 and over, along with the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, should be getting the vaccine, both to prevent and reduce the impact of zoster, and to prevent by two-thirds post-herpetic neuralgia. In the people who are 50 and over, because the impact is less in that group, there's much less post-herpetic neuralgia, but there's still post-herpetic neuralgia. I don't know about public policy. I know that if I were 52, I would forego a fancy dinner and get the vaccine.
So you're really saying that everybody age 50 and above, we should be thinking about, is this person a candidate for the vaccine? Ken, are there people that should not receive the vaccine?
Yes, the main contraindication is suppression of the cellular immune system. So individuals with leukemia, lymphoma, hematologic malignancies, some solid cancers on high doses of immunosuppressive drugs, prednisone and the like, should not get this live attenuated.
So I think your point is really it's people with damage to their cell-mediated immune system. We know, for example, that people who are agammaglobulinemic, who have humoral defects, can tolerate the vaccine. So maybe let's just ask one other practical point, Ken. Again, as a geriatrician, you face this. It has been a bit of a barrier, I would say, for many practitioners that this is a Part D covered vaccine. What are the implications for that?
That's correct. It is covered under Medicare Part D, not Part B. So for a practicing physician, since it's not a Medicare Part D covered intervention, you do not get the administration fee for the vaccine in the clinic, and furthermore, you can't bill Medicare Part D directly. Now, pharmacists can do that, and pharmacists can administer the vaccine.
So it really is an issue, because at least as of 2011, we're looking at zoster immunization rates for the age group that it's indicated for somewhere in the 10 to 11%. So the majority of people at risk for this disease have not received the vaccine. And hopefully the main point that's come through today is that prevention is superior to treatment.
I'd like to add one little point.
Sure.
And that is, I think, and I have no data to support this, that the unilateral pain, the prodromal pain, which is enormously severe, causes a great deal of diagnostic confusion, and people get expensive workups. They get cardiac catheterization because if it's going to come on the left side before the rash, you can't make the diagnosis. And during that period of time, there's an awful lot of cost put into things and a lot of potential harm to patients in working them up. So you need to have a high index of suspicion. And again, if you prevent shingles, you also prevent the prodromal pain.
You know, that's a nice point, Mike, and a nuance corollary to that is that the costs of all those workups tend not to get factored into the economic benefit of the vaccine, because by giving the vaccine, we reduce the incidence of zoster and hence reduce the need for those sorts of tests.
That's correct.
Very good. Well, thank you for participating in this activity. To proceed to the online CME post-test, just click on the Earn CME credit link on this page. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Herpes Zoster, Strategies for Prevention. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.